This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a regular series of coronavirus conversations, presented jointly with The Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We've been taking your questions to the experts. This discussion series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you right here in The World's podcast feed. Recently, I spoke with Yonatan Grad, an assistant professor in the Department of Immunology and Infectious Diseases at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We talked about more surges and growing concerns in the pandemic.
To start, the number of new cases of COVID-19, for context, in the United States, it pretty much peaked in July, declined for about 2 months. Then last month, the situation, it changed, and not for the better. Since mid-September, we've been seeing new cases steadily mounting. Breaking things down at the state and local level, we've observed dramatic surges in states like Utah, Wisconsin, North and South Dakota. And those places are far exceeding the number of cases they saw during the summer peaks. Even states that have been holding the virus in check are seeing local surges. Here in Massachusetts, Boston recently entered the red zone, which is the state's highest risk of emergency, or highest category. And in New York, areas of Brooklyn and Queens have emerged as new hotspots too. And that's prompted leaders there to reimpose restrictions. So, Yonatan, we've been expecting more surges, even what some have called a second wave. Are you seeing that happening? Is this it?
From a purely descriptive perspective, yes, absolutely. You know, we had one wave with a rise in cases, as you described, and then many places were able to flatten the curve through social distancing, masking, and other types of interventions, bringing those case numbers down. And now as we see them start to climb again, this is, from a descriptive perspective, a second wave. But I'd like to emphasize that unlike waves in nature, like waves in the ocean, we actually have the ability to control these waves. Really, they're a reflection of our choices and behavior individually and as communities. These choices really shape the extent of disease spread through our populations.
So when you think about that, why? What are some of the drivers of why we're now experiencing a rise in cases in parts of the United States, for example?
Yeah, so we know that the virus can spread so long as there are sufficient numbers of susceptible individuals to sustain spread and connection between infectious and susceptible individuals. So, and we have a good sense of what the risks are for accelerating that transmission. We know that it's a respiratory virus, it transmits through the air. Things like close contact, poor ventilation, activities like shouting and singing, all of those that generate droplets and aerosols, these increase the risk of transmission. So where we're starting to engage in those behaviors more than we had been, and there's connection with infectious individuals, we should expect to see that there will be spread. So this also means, of course, that we know what we can do to help suppress the spread of COVID-19. So social distancing, masking, meeting outdoors rather than indoors, and then really coupling that with extensive testing as well as contact tracing, case identification, and so on. Things that have been demonstrated to work. It's why we were able to flatten the curve before. And in fact, some countries even haven't seen a second wave. Those kinds of efforts we know work.
I want to get to that about other countries, but just in building off of you were talking about a need for testing, surveillance. You had an op-ed in the Washington Post co-authored recently that there isn't enough testing and surveillance data to really be figuring out the ways to tighten and loosen restrictions. So what are the gaps in that testing and monitoring right now that prevent that level of informed policy?
Yeah, so we have made big strides with testing. There's certainly more testing now, but we had a really slow start, and that put us behind the eight ball, and we have really not emerged from that situation yet. We just don't have enough testing across the country. And as we've heard in press reports regularly, the turnaround time for getting results from tests continues to be far too long to have the impact that testing can have, right? So being able to identify cases rapidly and then figure out who else is at risk, in the absence of being able to do that, or having these long delays, we would expect new cases to start off new transmission chains and outbreaks. So really the insufficient testing for broad community surveillance, I think continues to be a big challenge and is one of the reasons why we haven't been able to really, in many places, get a handle on the pandemic and help drive down the numbers.
When you look at globally, worldwide, how does what's happening in the United States fit into this context of where is the world at in this pandemic? And as we see surges happening in the United States, what else is happening around the globe?
Yeah, so we're seeing the choices that governments and communities are making play out in very different ways. In some places, the initial efforts for strict quarantine and isolation together with massive testing really helped stop transmission. China, for example, had the first cases, right, and had this wave in Wuhan, but they were able to suppress it with fairly strict measures that they've been able to, you know, now life there has returned somewhat back to normal as they continue to maintain extensive surveillance. Other countries like Israel did a good job initially in suppressing spread, but then let up on those efforts. And we're seeing massive spread in Israel now leading to a second lockdown, right? So having to use this broad measure of community quarantine as a way to try to slow disease spread. And we're seeing similar kinds of up and down introduction of social distancing and other types of interventions, lockdown interventions in different places. In Spain, there was actually just recently a legal battle about this, but the federal government wanted to introduce restrictive measures in Madrid. In Paris, more restrictive measures have been introduced. Scotland, the same. Some towns in northern England to try to control what has been rising case numbers in each of those places. But other countries like South Korea, Singapore, they've been able, after their initial efforts, basically they have occasional blips, but they've been able to keep the numbers low. And New Zealand, aided, of course, by being a kind of island country, initially actually it was able to remove COVID-19 spread almost totally. And after, again, an introduction, now has yet again almost essentially eradicated spread in their country. So the different choices that countries make really have had huge impacts on the trajectory of the pandemic in their populations.
And yet still, I mean, this week, the director of the World Health Organization said about more than people had expected, about 10% of people may have been exposed to the virus, but that still leaves like 90% of the global community susceptible. And so it seems like choice is one part of it, but it still seems like, do you see this as still in the beginning of things when you think about how many people out there?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think it is still in towards the beginning for precisely the reason you mentioned. So much of the population remains susceptible that you know the possibility of continued spread and continued struggle with the pandemic for some time into the foreseeable future, I think is right. And this is, you know, one of the reasons why so much emphasis has been placed on innovation medically, right? So coming up with new therapies so that we can treat people and reduce the severity of disease, and vaccines to help prevent disease. So you know, people talk about the fact, well, you know, if everyone's going to get it anyway, why does it matter? Why are we doing these kinds of interventions? And I think the advances that we've seen with new therapeutics, or the use of old therapeutics to help reduce the severity of disease, so like the use of dexamethasone, for example, or new drugs like remdesivir, newly applied here, or the monoclonal antibody cocktail that we've heard so much about over the past couple of weeks. From
You're talking about the treatments that President Trump has received.
Exactly. So as we develop these new tools, we're able to better treat individuals. So all of these efforts to help suppress the spread of the virus means that it's giving us a time frame, a window in which to develop the new tools to help reduce the mortality, reduce the severity of disease, or even prevent it as we get effective vaccines. So these efforts, even if large fractions of the population remain susceptible, these efforts to help develop these new tools can have massive benefits in the longer term, even if we see continued spread.
Just there's some questions coming in from online, so I want to be sure that we get to some of this too, but I have more follow-ups as well. In contextualizing around the availability of treatments, where we're at in the pandemic, seeing new surges, for example, in the United States, this question from online is, you know, in the spring, we resorted to a lot of broad shutdowns, and that was one of the only weapons readily available, I guess you could say, in our arsenal, to use that sort of metaphor. Are we now better prepared to contain outbreaks without resorting to those kinds of sweeping restrictions? And we've also seen this kind of politically play out in the vice presidential debates yesterday about how this is being handled and how to handle it moving forward. Should there be more widespread restrictions and things like that?
I think one of the challenges, of course, is that at the beginning of the pandemic, our understanding of disease spread, risk areas, what kinds of activities were risky, was still very much in its infancy. And we've advanced in our understanding of what types of activities contribute to risk, and then what we can do, therefore, to reduce that risk. And I think that's where, again, we return to these ideas of limiting interactions among groups, indoors with loud speaking and so on, these kinds of activities that we know promote transmission. Being able to address those, promote masking and so on, I think continue to be interventions that can help us avoid the blunt instrument of community lockdown and target them, particularly as we get better and more testing and are able to do more surveillance. We can identify those populations that are at highest risk of continued spread, or where we're seeing the most spread, and try to focus. So advances both in our understanding of transmission and advances, and there's a continued need for advances in availability of testing, I think can all help us avoid the lockdown scenario. But if we get back to a situation where there's just completely uncontrolled spread, continues to be a looming possibility, knowing the huge challenges associated with it. I'm sorry.
I was going to just ask, and following up from that, this question is from Andrea from the World's Facebook page. Are these slow turnaround times right now for testing results, is that a specifically United States sort of thing, or what can be learned from other countries?
Yeah, so I think there are some areas in the United States where turnaround times are very slow. It's not even everywhere in the US. I think, again, availability of testing, availability of reagents, increasing manufacturing, increasing the clinical lab capacity to be able to run these tests, all of those things can be addressed. You know, you mentioned the political situation, and of course the debate yesterday and continuing issues around making this into, I think, a central issue for the election. And I think it deservedly is one. There was recently, just yesterday actually, an editorial in the New England Journal that I think really held the administration, rightfully held the administration accountable for many of the failures that have led to now over 210,000 deaths. The United States has a death rate of around 500 per million. This compares to the reported death rate in China, for example, where we know there were the first outbreaks of 3 per million. Right? So there have been, I think, really important failures, massive failures of federal leadership here that I think could have, had they approached this differently, we would be in a different situation.
And so reiterating, what are the ways that when it comes to improving testing and the monitoring, what are the specific steps that would help you do that better?
Yeah, so focusing more on rolling out testing, so getting more, both improving what we have in terms of the clinical lab capacity, available manufacturing of the tests themselves, expanding the types of tests that we use, developing, you know, there are a number, there's been a huge amount of innovation in developing new types of tests. And developing rapid tests, so tests where instead of, you know, with the current PCR test, it's, you know, at least 8-hour turnaround, and often it takes days just because of backlog. But there are some tests that are being developed that can do this, you know, within 15 minutes, half an hour, 1 hour. Really trying to push forward and the manufacturing and the continued innovation of diagnostics, I think, will. Is a critical piece here. And then in terms of surveillance, many of the, many public health departments have been underfunded chronically, and their infrastructure for information technology, for monitoring, for data analysis, and development of new plans continues to be hindered by that long-term lack of funding. So investing in our public health system, in developing new information technology that can be both local, of use locally, but then of use more broadly, integrating data from across municipalities, regions, the whole country, I think could be transformative.
So given where we're at now, this question comes from Lexi Cohen. Do you think a place like Massachusetts, which was a national hotspot early on, has the potential to become a hotspot again, and that a second lockdown, for example, would be necessary soon?
I think any place that has the sufficient number of susceptible individuals to sustain spread is going to be at risk. Right? It's basically that's the determining factor for whether you could see spread. So the possibility is there. But I think in Massachusetts, there have been many advances in developing tools to help monitor and then respond to increases in cases. And we're seeing that take place as, you know, there's been a delay, for example, in school opening in Boston, and we'll have to see what other interventions Boston city government and Massachusetts Commonwealth decide to enact if we see a continued rise. Should we expect to see a continued rise? I would say so, for a couple of reasons. One, in areas where you have a lot of college towns, and Boston is one of those, we had an influx of people from around the country. I saw an estimate that around 20% of university students in the Boston area hail from California, Florida, and Texas, which back in late August, as these students were coming back to school for the start of the semester, were hotspots, right? So there's the expected introduction of cases. Campuses are not hermetically sealed bubbles, right? They are within our communities. And so as there start to be cases on campuses, we should then expect those to appear in our communities. As we start to open up more and more our schools, where kids will interact with one another, families will interact, and try to open up other elements of the economy as well, just have more opportunity for spread. So as numbers get higher, we would then expect to see continued spread, unless we have, again, testing and interventions, contact tracing, and so on, that can help with efforts, isolation, quarantine, to bring things back down.
This is another question from online building off of that. I mean, it sounds like colleges and educational institutions can play a role in driving outbreaks. What are your concerns about how COVID-19 may spread differently during the fall and winter, and how that might play into things too? When you talked about, for at least on the East Coast and parts of the United States, people are outside and more distanced in the summer months.
Yes, this is an important point and one I had intended to raise earlier, so I'm very glad for the question. From early on, there was uncertainty about the extent of seasonality of SARS-CoV-2. So by seasonality, I mean variable transmission in the different seasons. For many respiratory viruses, we see higher rates of transmission in the colder months, fall and winter, and lower rates in the summer. We see that with the other coronaviruses that circulate through human populations and cause common cold-type syndromes. They have this kind of seasonal pattern where they peak in colder months. Influenza similarly has this pattern. In fact, most respiratory viruses that we know of follow this pattern. For flu, it's at least in part due to meteorological factors. So lower absolute humidity is associated, as we see in January, February, is associated with more transmission. But there are also behavioral features as well. So again, for influenza, we know that kids are big vectors of flu. And so as they congregate in schools and then go out into the communities, that is a risk for accelerating transmission. And it is possible that that's going to be the case as well for COVID-19. So both the behavioral features is, again, people spend more time indoors. Those behaviors that we were talking about that increase risk, being indoors, being unmasked, and so on, those could contribute to rising cases if we don't have the opportunities to be social outdoors as we did in the summer months. But then there may also be other more biological factors as well that we're not certain of. But I would expect, in fact, we have every reason to expect, based on what we see with other respiratory viruses, that there will be accelerated transmission in the colder months. Some data, in fact, from the Southern Hemisphere showed that as well.
This question's from Kristen. It's about voting, actually, and sometimes people are waiting hours in close contact with other people. Has this been something you've looked at or thought about in terms of how the transmission risks of voting?
Yeah, so I don't know details about, I haven't seen much of it. There may be some out there and I just haven't seen it, about what the circumstances are for voting. Certainly, your risk is reduced by masking, by trying to keep social distancing. And if the lines are outdoors rather than indoors, that helps reduce risk as well. But I haven't seen much data on whether, for example, voting in primaries led to outbreaks. We know that there's good data to suggest that something like, you know, an indoor rally like what took place in Tulsa was associated with a rise in cases subsequently in Tulsa. But I haven't seen data suggesting as much for voting in the primary season.
This question is from the World's Facebook page. It's kind of now taking a more zoom out view, I guess you could say. At one point this summer, it looked like the US, Brazil, and Russia were the top three areas of concern being top in terms of number of cases and deaths. What about now? Are those regions still of top concern? And then what do you see as driving the spread of the virus in those places? I think it brings it back to some of the things you talked about at the beginning of the conversation.
Yeah, I think that that's right. I think, well, the U.S. leads the world in cases and deaths, right, and continues to. And that, I think, again, is just a reflection of the failure of leadership and the ability to put in place sustained efforts to help slow or stop the transmission of the virus. Brazil continues to have many cases. India has had many cases. And so there are a few areas of the world where we see extensive spread. And I think in many cases, it gets back to this, this understanding of the types of activities that promote transmission. Having good extensive systematic testing so that we can really identify cases and then isolate the cases, quarantine the contacts, and do what we can, what we know works in terms of interventions to stop transmission.
There is one additional, big additional aspect to all of this, and that's the development of a vaccine. And so if and when an effective vaccine comes into play, how does that play out? Because I know that you've been looking at, you and your colleagues, at this question of like, how do you prioritize what groups should get a vaccine first and how to then prevent more transmission, more surges, how to save the most lives. What are you finding in that regards to that?
Yeah, so vaccines can have their effect in a few ways. They can prevent infection. They can limit the severity of disease if infected. And then they can limit the transmission of the virus. The vaccine trials currently are really focused on trying to understand limiting the extent to which the vaccines limit the severity of disease, and not so much on trying to limit transmission. So I think, you know, in some ways, our what we'll glean from these trials is how well vaccines can protect people from dying or from developing severe symptoms. But understanding their impact on transmission is, of course, hugely important for trying to limit the extent of spread. Both, you know, limiting both things, of course, is what we would like. What we were looking at was this question of if you had a vaccine that could achieve both, how would you distribute it, knowing that a vaccine initially, at least, will be manufactured only in sufficient quantities for a limited set of the population. So how do you prioritize vaccine distribution? If you want to reduce deaths, then what we found, and this I think makes just common sense, is that you want to target those individuals who are at highest risk for dying from the disease. So the elderly population, for example. And this actually held true even if the effectiveness of the vaccine is lower in those individuals. And I bring up that point because we know that for many vaccines, like flu, for example, the effectiveness in older age groups is less than what we see in younger age groups. So even in that context, vaccinating the at-risk population first will help reduce deaths. If we want to reduce spread overall, then vaccinating, at least as we looked at the numbers in the US, given our demographics and the kind of interaction patterns that we know exist, that targeting the younger individuals is how we should prioritize vaccination. But I think we recently had recommendations from the National Academy where, again, they said prioritizing the essential workers, healthcare workers, and then those at highest risk for dying from the disease is how we should prioritize. There are many, many logistical questions about how you implement this kind of vaccination program. And I think those cannot be overstated. I mean, both rolling out the vaccine, finding the individuals. For many of these vaccines, they're two-dose vaccines, so you need to where people need to get doses 2 weeks apart. How do you make sure you do that? If people are in a few different categories of risk, how do you find them? If they initially aren't findable and you started giving vaccine to other people and then they decide to come back. I mean, there are many complexities here. I could go on and on, but this is, I think, one of the big challenges our public health system is now facing too.
We're about out of time. I wanted to ask you, if there's some certain driving questions as we wrap up the conversation that you're still trying to figure out, that you still don't know. And it sort of comes off of a question that just came in from Georgianne, which is, what's the reinfection concern for the elderly who had the virus as they return to nursing and assisted living facilities? So I wonder if in responding to that, then additionally, if you might be able to wrap up with some kind of key insights that you have in terms of like, we've learned so much, but also being mindful of the things we still don't know.
Right, and I think that question about how long does immunity last is a fundamental one and totally critical to developing response. And it's the same question, not only for natural infection, but also for a vaccine. Does the vaccine confer lifelong protection against infection, or does it wane quickly, like what we have seen with other, like the common cold coronaviruses, where it seems like people can get reinfected a year after their initial infection? I think getting a better handle on the strength and duration of immune protection from both natural infection and from the vaccine candidates is absolutely critical to shaping a policy to come.
And then finally, as you think about the realities of people getting to work, trying to live their lives, but also managing these unknowns of the surveillance information that you're trying to get, the testing information, what are some of the key things that you've learned about how people can kind of manage these unknowns and try to prevent transmissions moving forward?
Right. This gives us an opportunity to underscore those issues we've talked about a couple of times, where we know what can help lower the risk of transmission: masking, outdoor versus indoor activities, social distancing. These kinds of efforts, I think, reduce the risk of spread and are ones that we should continue to be mindful of.
That was Yonatan Grad, an assistant professor in the Department of Immunology and Infectious Diseases at Harvard School of Public Health. This Q&A was jointly presented by the Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can find the video of this discussion on our Facebook pages, at Forum HSPH and at PRI The World, and see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening.
From PRX.